Welcome to the Vancouver International Film Festival podcast, a podcast dedicated to some of the most exciting live conversations that happen at the festival and our year-round program. I'm your host, Ken Tsui, Director of Creative Engagement and Live Programming here at the festival, and in this episode, we present Dan Gore, the co-creator and executive producer of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Brooklyn Nine-Nine follows an ensemble cast of New York City detectives who absolutely nail it when it comes to solving cases, having each other's backs, and smashing stereotypes. It strikes a balance between playful humor and heartfelt, down-to-earth drama, lending a sincere and thoughtful commentary to social issues including gun control, sexism, and racial profiling. Needless to say, it's one of the funniest and most progressive shows on primetime television. Gore is joined by actor Sonia Bennett on the year-round talk stage to discuss.
Hello.
Is it just on?
Is this on? Can you guys hear us?
Yeah. Okay, so Dan.
Yes.
Let's start at the beginning, your origin story.
So my parents...
Diving right in.
Yeah.
Where were you born?
I was born in Washington, D.C., Bethesda, Maryland area. Mm-hmm. Does anyone know where that is? I mean, you know where Washington, D.C. is, I guess. I was born. It's like right next to the National Institutes of Health, so it's like a very science-y area. Mm-hmm. And I say that because I kind of grew up working in labs, and I went
like
to college.
As a child?
Yeah, even as a child.
You worked in labs as a child?
If the experiment is on you, does that count as working? They did things to me. No, my summer job was like working in a lab. When I was like in seventh grade, eighth grade.
That makes me nervous.
For the state of healthcare now?
Yes.
We were working on a virus and I was, no. what kind of stuff? I worked for this guy, Makio Murayama. We worked on platelets.
Okay.
He's actually a very fascinating guy. I think I just jumped the gun on your question. But the basic point is I grew up there, very normal background, did a lot of acting, wrote a lot of stories. I was always afraid to write comedy stuff because I liked being funny with my friends, and I think I was afraid that when I put pen to paper, it wouldn't be funny, and so I wrote a lot about the Holocaust. Like, in fourth and fifth grade, every story I wrote started with, I'm on the boxcar, and the light is filtering through the slats. I'm Jewish, so
Wait,
I don't know if that makes it better. I'm just saying.
Didn't you tell me backstage that your daughter is currently doing a report
yes.
on Anne Frank?
My 8-year-old daughter is currently writing a report that's like, I'm in a boxcar. And not a great thing to joke about, but for real, that was like the kind of writing I did was like very serious. I wrote in seventh grade, I took a writing class, and I wrote a book of poems called Dodecahedron, which is a 12-sided, I must have just learned what it was. It's a 12-sided figure, and the lead poem was like, Dodecahedron, 12 angry men. Dodecahedron, sit in judgment of one. And it was like about a death sentence. I mean, so I was like very...
It sounds amazing.
Yeah. It was not. It was bad. But meanwhile, I was also doing a lot of comedy. By that, I mean like mm-hmm. was being in plays and joking around in them.
What do your parents do? Or did you grow up in a creative household?
Again, I grew up in a lab. No, my dad and mom are actually very interesting. My dad was a biochemist and worked at NIH.
What's NIH?
National Institutes of Health.
Got it.
But then he and my mom always had other things they were doing. So they wrote 7 children's books, nonfiction, black and white children's books about insects. One taught kids to read. It was about signs. So it was like learning how to read by looking at signs. One about shadows. One called In the Driver's Seat. So they wrote all these books. And my dad, when he was at NIH, I don't know if you guys remember when cholesterol was a thing. You're all pretty young. But like in the mid-80s, he worked on that big cholesterol study. And then he and my mom wrote a book called Eater's Choice, A Food Lover's Guide to Lower Cholesterol. And so they were always kind of writing.
What was an average dinner at your house like?
Oh my God, that is such a good question. And I can answer it immediately. There was always a soup.
Okay.
Like a mulligatawny or a vegetable soup, then steamed brown rice, baked chicken, steamed broccoli, some kind of mashed up squash, mm-hmm. And then usually one or maybe one or two more vegetables.
This is very produce intense.
Yeah, they're very regular household. But yes, so dinner and a lot. We ate a lot and we ate very quickly. That was it. And then when I was, a big transformative thing that happened to me is, so my brother was a really gifted pianist. And when he was 14, he moved to New York to go to Juilliard. And he lived with a family and he played piano there. And then when he graduated from high school and went on to college, that family said, if your brother wants to come move to New York, they can live with us and go to this school. So the school he had gone to was called St. Anne's, and it's a very liberal school with no grades and an unbelievable arts program. And it's had, like, Lena Dunham went there. It's, like, very, it's really arts forward. Mm-hmm. And so I went there when I was 16, and I lived with this family. And that, I think, was really eye-opening and exciting. And it was like living in Brooklyn. There were only three rules. I had to tell them if I was bringing somebody home for dinner, if I was going to miss dinner, and if I wasn't sleeping there.
Wow.
So it was like freedom. And I'd come from a really suburban background, and then that was a really urban world.
Wow. And your parents were not there.
Didn't know I did it.
No, they didn't notice you were gone.
Did not care. No, they, you know, it is, I have two kids now, and I can't imagine letting them do that, but I think, I don't know. I mean, I think because my brother had done it, it had really paved the way.
Sure.
Maybe I was a really annoying kid. I don't know. They seemed so much happier after I left. So then I went there, and then I went to college. And when I was in college, Mike Schur, who co-created the show with me, and then he also had co-created Parks and Rec, and he created The Good
Place.
How
did you meet him?
So he and I were originally nemeses.
Okay.
There were like two factions.
So this is in college.
This is in college. So we were both freshmen, we both tried out for plays, and there were sort of two factions.
Did you want to be an actor?
I did more acting.
You were
than
an actor.
No, I mean I was an actor in those plays. I wasn't a professional like yourself. But I dabbled, let's say. But there were two factions, and they were like, it was like the Jets and the Sharks of the theater world in the college. And so he was sort of adopted by one group, and I was adopted by another.
Well, what was the difference between these two groups?
In truth, I think the one he was adopted by had a lot of talent, and the one I was adopted by didn't. But after a semester, and we were like, they would be like, Mike's so funny. And I'd be like, ugh. And then my sort of supporters would be like, Dan's really funny. And he'd be like, I doubt it, you know. And then we did a play together or something, and we became best friends.
What was the play?
The first play we did together, that is a great question. You know what? I'm totally blanking on what play we did together.
Take your time.
That's a great question. What play did... Oh, I think it was a student-written play.
Yes. Those are the best kind.
Those are the best. And it was by somebody in his faction, and I got brought into his faction. So I went from being a shark to being a jet.
Oh. Whoa.
What are you guys... They were better. You guys think I'm betraying the Jets? You don't know them. They were jerks. No, really everyone became sort of friends. That's not true. They still didn't get along. But I'm lifelong friends with these people now. God, now I feel terrible. I could live life again. Anyway, so we did a lot of plays together. Mm-hmm. And some of the plays were...
Acting in them.
And mostly they were comedies. And I had a really obnoxious attitude of like, it's fun to improvise. Even if the person's play was like, the person was like Neil Simon, I'd be like, I'll beat that joke.
Screw you, Shakespeare. Yeah. Watch this.
Screw thou, Shakespeare.
Yes.
No. But within reason. And then, we also did serious plays. I was in a play, Rhinoceros, by Ionesco. And Chris Terrio is a writer. Do you guys know who he is? He wrote the movie Argo. He was in the play. He was very serious actor. And he had the part where he had to transform Zero Mostel's part into a rhinoceros. And he would physicalize it. And he fully punched me in the face one day. And then I was like, I'm just done with
like
theater.
On stage?
On stage. Because he'd be like, oh! And he went, whoosh!
And then it was like this. Like you in rhino mode.
In rhino mode.
Like by accident.
I don't know. Again,
yeah,
we didn't
okay.
get.
Yeah, got
he
you.
Was in the other faction. See, yeah. Don't you understand why we were all about love, but you guys want me to be with the punchers. So then Mike and I, and we did like a student written play. We got really into, are there any theatery people here? Like theater people? Everyone was kind of like, the way I said theatery, they're like, yeah. But we were like, we were doing like movement stuff. So we did this play called Six Viewpoints where we built it from movement stuff. It was a lot of like stage architecture.
Could we see a little bit of that?
I mean, a lot of it would be like. And then somebody else would be like. But then it was also funny. I mean,
that
like,
was
then
amazing.
We
would, thank
yeah,
you.
No problem. Theater. No, but and Mike and I, and there was another guy, Charlie Grandy, who wrote on The Office subsequently and The Mindy Project. And he and I, so Charlie and Mike and I were kind of like a trio who did these things. Mm-hmm. And then I was going to go to medical school. I was enrolled in medical school. I was
so
biochemistry major.
This was just
major.
Like for fun.
This was just for fun, but I did
serious.
A lot of, yeah. I was a biochemistry major, but I probably did like 15 or 20 plays in college. I mean, I did a lot of theater. And then.
But wait, were you studying theater?
I took a few theater classes, but mostly I studied by doing.
Wow.
Also, I was not a good actor, it should be pointed out. I should have studied theater. And I was on the improv team and stuff like that. So then, woo! It was short form. It wasn't that cool. Although at the time, we didn't know what long form was. So it's weird to be like old based on your improv experience. But and then I was going to go to medical school, but I got very lucky and I got a grant to travel for 1 year. So it was like $17,000 to travel for 1 year. And the only stipulation was you couldn't stay in the country.
Well, did you have to gather
something?
It was
something? My parents who gave it to me. They were like, get the fuck away. No, it was literally a grant whose design was to be transformative, like to take people who were on a path or not sure what
people
path.
People who needed to grow.
People who needed to grow. Yeah, emotionally and physically. I was 4'3" at the time. No, it was, it was 1997 mm-hmm. and the tech boom had happened. So I think the endowment for that specific award had just doubled or something because they gave two of them out and they were very generous. So I went to England and I studied clown.
Did you choose, did you get to choose where you were going to go?
Yes. In fact, when I went in, I was like, for the interview, because they interviewed three of us for two slots. And I went in.
How do you win that? Like, what did you have to?
It really was very lucky. And I think part of it was also being somebody who didn't really have a plan for what they were going to do. I was going to defer med school for a year. But I think if I had, like, already had a job, I don't think I would have really been in contention.
They wouldn't have paid you to go backpacking.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I took clown with Philippe Gollier, who was this guy who worked with Jacques Lecoq. And he is an asshole. Like, he's great, but like clown teachers are noted assholes. He's one of the funniest people I've ever met, but he would be like, it made me hate performing because he'd be like, who here thought that was good and who here thought that was a piece of shit?
Yeah.
And then like the other students would be like, I thought that was good. And he's like, you're a liar. It was a piece of shit. And he would say about me, he said, you're American with big American teeth. That was his big thing. And then he called some woman a vacuum cleaner because of her voice. I mean, it was like insane. And for the right person, it was great. Like he really, Sacha Baron Cohen was not there when I was there, but he took from that guy. And it's like, for the right person, he was able.
Person who likes to be mocked.
Well, I think interestingly, Sacha Baron Cohen, there's also Buffon, which is like a variant. I think that's kind of what Sasha does. And I think he really tapped into the fact that Sacha Baron Cohen is a genius and he knew what to do with him. But like, he couldn't take somebody. He hated English speakers.
Well, you're a words person.
Yes.
So and that's mime has little words, yeah, or maybe no words.
He would kill you if you heard the word mime, though, because he hates mimes. One day I was like, have you heard of Jacques Tati? And he's like, Jacques Tati is an S. And I was like, okay, I'm so sorry. I hate him too. But the... It was interesting because I really felt like I know how dangerous it is to just make blanket generalizations, but I'm going to do
it.
There, it was a very international group of people who took the class. And it, the interesting thing was the Spaniards were really good. And I think there's like a kind of jokey, pranky culture in Spain. And so like really great clown is not having a plan and not thinking of the joke. It's being in the moment and being like open to the moment. And when somebody can really tap into their clown, it's really some of the funniest, most naturally funny thing. And I think English speakers, even our best comedians, like even like Monty Python and stuff, it's very verbal, it's very cerebral. Yeah. And so he, it was horrible. I mean, there was one exercise, which sounds like it was so easy. All you had to do, and I'm sure you would have been great at this because you're a great actress, but I like you get up, so you had to go up on stage and just go, you have to say your name and say, I love performing and I want to be here. And you had to say it in a way that convinced him. I mean, it wasn't supposed to be funny.
That sounds awful.
Yeah. And I got up there and I'm like, my name is Dan Gore and I love performing and I want to be here. And he was like, fuck you, sit down, you piece of shit. And so like, then I was like, you know what, I'm done. I'm just done taking clown classes. So I then, a friend of mine's uncle or cousin was a barrister. And so I like shadowed a barrister on a murder trial, which was fascinating.
Okay, what's a barrister? I'm no idea.
Barrister is
that.
Like a British lawyer. They have solicitors and barristers. The barristers are the ones who actually are in court. And he was okay. A big time lawyer. He was like Queen's Counsel, which means he like took the silk. And it was like this great experience. And it was in this town called Lewis, which had its own, it had a pub. And the pub had a special room just for the barristers.
Oh,
and
cool.
You could get free sherry in that room. And so we had the case, I won't go into the whole details of the case, but it was two co-defendants and they were blaming each other. And they had been boyfriend and girlfriend. And they were both not very intelligent people. But we were representing the man, and we said to the woman's lawyer, that my guy said, I hope you know, I intend to cut your throat. Because it's called a cutthroat defense, and the other one, and I would expect no less. It was amazing. So, and the truth of the matter was, she had done, in all versions, she had done the stabbing. It was just whether he had been complicit. But our guy got off. It was fine. For real. There was also a great moment in that. Whatever. So I did that, and then I traveled around the world.
What were you doing for this barrister?
I was just his little buddy. Like we would take the train down from England.
You were paid
I was
to be his
Charles
little
Boyle.
Buddy?
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's so smart. You'll get him next time. No, I mean like
he turned into Sean Wallace.
Yeah, he would like tell me what he was going to do, and then I'd be like, oh, that's cool. And then I mean, really, I was shadowing him. I wasn't.
Right.
I mean, the one thing I thought I would do that was cool. The woman was epileptic, and she said she had done a certain thing, and I was like, I wonder if she could have that drink and take the epilepsy medicine she claims. So dramatically during the trial, I like leaned over the bar and said to the barrister, I'll be right back. And I ran down to a Boots pharmacy and I was like, could you drink alcohol if you were on this medication? And they're like, oh yeah, that would be no problem. And I was like, okay. Like, I mean, we don't recommend it, but really no problem at all. I'm like, really, for everyone, no problem. Wouldn't turn you into a murderer. Why would you say that randomly? Then I went back and they were, I mean, then he was like, everything okay? I was like, yeah, stomach thing. So that was that. And then I traveled around the world and I went, it was this crazy, great trip. It was Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, Australia, Thailand. And then I took the Trans-Siberian, which I totally recommend, from Beijing to Moscow.
Wow.
And that was fantastic. And then
all of this in a year.
That was all half a year. And I think I was scared to do that. And so if I had really thought about it, I mean, I wouldn't trade in for the barrister experience for anything. I would definitely
you
trade in
have that
the clown
accent
experience.
In the story. Yeah.
Yeah. There was actually a great moment in it where the guy who got killed had earlier, he was an old man and he was the town drunk, and he had earlier had a surgery to remove half of his intestines. Mm-hmm. And so there was a chance that that might have contributed to the death because he wasn't because of his constitution. So file that away. And we were petitioning to have the whole case dismissed, and the guy who was the judge didn't come from the criminal justice system. He had really mostly done insurance work. And so he stopped our petition to have it thrown out because of a grammatical error. So he went, Mr. Salin, I notice you've used a semicolon. Do you think perhaps you should have used a colon? And my barrister was like, what? Anyway, so then later in the kind of stuff I brought to it was when we were doing our closing arguments, I was like, oh, maybe you should say to the judge, perhaps the victim died because he in fact had a semicolon. He didn't do it. Wait, totally related thing. A parent at my kid's school is a lawyer, and he was like a slip and fall kind of lawyer, and he was representing a guy. He was suing a landlord because an old man had slipped on the stairs of his domicile and had died. He'd like broken his neck, and so his kids were suing the landlord. Mm-hmm. And the steps, the guy was really old, and it's probably why he slipped, but the steps were off code by an eighth of an inch. So they were pretty much to code. Mm-hmm. And so I said to him, I think what you should do is during the trial, you should move a glass like this and just leave it there. And then you should say, you know, the steps were only off by an eighth of an inch, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it can be the difference between this and that, or whatever. And then like weeks later, I saw him at the playground and I was like, Dylan, did you do it? And he's like, I did it. And I was like, all right. And he goes, we did not win. So I do not trust my legal experience whatsoever. So from there, I got back to America. I'm still answering your first question. I should point out. I got back to America, and Charlie Grandy, the other guy who did the plays with us, was Mike had gotten a job at SNL, and Charlie at Saturday Night Live while I was gallivanting,
yes.
While I was solving the world's legal crises, and. Charlie was going to apply for a job. Medical school was to start in 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. And we were going to write a packet. He was going to write a packet for SNL. And I said, can I write a packet with you? And he was like, sure, but you have to take it really seriously, man. And I was like, I will. And
so then you were going to apply.
I was going to apply with him as a writing team.
As a team. And medical school was
I was like 4 weeks away. It was like, no, it was like the last, this was like the last ditch effort.
Because you'd put in so much work into your career at this point. If it didn't work out here, you might as well go to medical school.
Because, like, my dream, there's a guy, an English guy named Jonathan Miller who recently died, and he was in Beyond the Fringe, and he was a medical doctor. He went to medical school with Oliver Sacks, and I was like, my dream is to be him, which is impossible now. I mean, he was doing that in, like, the 1960s or 50s or whatever. But, So we started to write a packet.
What do you have to write?
For SNL, you had to write, back at that time, you had to write like four or five sketches, and you had to write three commercial parodies, I think. And we really were not doing a good job. Like, our ideas were all bad. We did a Free to Be You and Me parody, which is a thing that had happened like 30 years before. And then he went to, like, he bumped into a woman that he had gone to kindergarten with.
Okay.
And she was like, he was like, what are you up to? And she said, I am the assistant, like the executive assistant to the showrunner of The Daily Show. Mm. And The Daily Show had just started, and this was before Jon Stewart was there. It had been going for, I think, a year or two, and Craig Kilborn was the host. Mm-hmm. And she was like, we're actually looking for writers. So Charlie and I submitted a packet to The Daily Show, and that
the same
was...
Same packet?
Different packet. That was a very specific packet. So they gave you four, I think things have changed. It was also one of the few places you could submit without an agent. Mm. But they gave you four or five headlines and the AP News story from the AP Newswire. And then you had to write jokes. So we wrote jokes. We wrote up their stories the way that they do. And we handed them in. And then
How much time did you have?
That was like a Monday that we I think we had 1 week to write it. We handed it in, and then they said they liked it, but they didn't know us. We didn't know anybody there. So they said, we want to make sure it's not a fluke. Can you do another set? Mm-hmm. So they gave us another set to do. And meanwhile, med school was now 3 weeks away. Mm-hmm. We handed that in, and then they invited us over, and we went there and watched the show. And then afterwards, they said, congratulations, we're hiring you. And I was like, for real? Can I tell medical school? And they were like, no, become a doctor. What are you doing? And I was like, anybody can become a doctor. Sort of true. Just kidding. Are there any doctors here? You are a hero. What kind of doctor?
Wait, is this the not a doctor thing?
That's the not a doctor thing.
I was going to ask you that. It was going to be my last question.
Yeah, that
I just
whole story
got it.
Is the not a doctor. Yeah.
Did I just ruin the punchline?
No. It was no punchline. You saved my ass. No, for real.
That's
awesome. The not a doctor. And also, like, I would always talk about pandemics and hot zones and stuff like that. And then my friends would be like, not a doctor. And I'd be like, shh. So that's where it comes from. And the person saying not a doctor is Mike. Sure.
Oh, no way.
And then Fremulon is Nick Offerman from Parks and Rec saying Fremulon.
So you got the job.
Got the job, was there for 3 years, then was at Conan for 5 years. Then Charlie and I split up as a writing team. Then I went to Conan, he went to SNL. And then Mike was at The Office, and he said that he was starting another show with Greg Daniels.
Okay, wait, let's slow down. Okay, writing for Conan, what was that like?
That was fantastic. Does anyone watch Conan? All right. I'll tell them it was overwhelming response. But back then it was the late night show. It was the one on NBC before the Tonight Show. And Conan is a genius. I mean, he's really like a standard deviation funnier than anybody I've ever been around. And he's also just an incredibly smart and generous and nice person. That was fun. We worked in the 30 Rock building, the mm-hmm. actual building that is 30 Rock. The hours were like 11 a.m. until often 11 p.m. Every day you were writing stuff. The thing about it that was great was, so I was there for 3 years. Every day you're writing for that day. If you don't get anything on, there's always the next day. If you get something on and it bombs, there's always the next day.
So you can't be precious.
You can't be precious. And I really, for a little while when I was hiring writers for Brooklyn, I've tried a lot of different things, but one thing I tried was like, oh, we've got to get late night writers because they won't be, they, one thing that happens, I think it's a real, like, it's an Achilles heel for a lot of writers is they become too attached to their material, right. Especially in a room. It's like, you'll see it happen time and time again where a person will have a pitch. It might be a great pitch, but it might just not be the right pitch for that moment. Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't get chosen and you just see the person shut down. If that happens a few times, they might just stop piping up. And, you know, the training on a show like The Daily Show, I wrote 5,000 jokes when I was at The Daily Show, literally 5,000
wow.
jokes. And when I was at Conan, you're writing, you know, 100 things for every 6 things that get, I guess I could have said 50 for 3, but whatever.
That sounded better.
Yeah. For every 6 things that get picked up. So you have to get a thicker skin.
Yeah.
It also... So people shut down. And then the other thing I notice is a real Achilles heel is people pitch something and then the room will move away from that pitch, but then the room will circle back to that pitch and they won't get credit for it. Mm-hmm. And it'll eat them alive that they didn't get credit. But at least when I'm running a show, I don't care who pitched the thing.
Yeah.
Like you're in the room already. You already have credit.
Yeah.
It's like sometimes it just takes... either just the showrunner mm-hmm. time for his or her mind to come around to it, or it just takes the room sort of hive mentality to realize that was the right idea.
Right.
So it's a real dance. Like you have to be willing to put yourself out there time and time again and get rejected. Mm-hmm. You have to know when to advocate for yourself. I mean, I think there are ways you can go afterwards in a situation like that. If you pitched something and then mm-hmm. the room went away from it and then came back, you could, if you were nervous, come up to a showrunner afterwards alone.
Remember that was my idea?
Or just go like, I know this sounds lame, but I just want you to know that I did pitch that in the beginning and I know things happened. I just want to make sure you don't think I'm not doing anything or something like that.
Really?
I don't know.
That sounds kind of lame.
It does, but I'd rather have somebody do that than just shut down and be like...
Well, be a sulky bitch.
Yeah. Your words, not mine. Yeah. 100%. But yeah. I'm just saying that's like a thing. I mean, I do think it's really valuable. That was very valuable training. The other thing about Conan that was really valuable was the writers write and produce and direct all of their own pieces. So, and that's based on the SNL model. So, like,
the writers direct their own pieces.
Yeah.
And on SNL too.
On SNL, I think the director, there is a director, but I think, so maybe on SNL they don't direct
it. Okay.
But on, yeah, so it's great. It's like really, it's a real opportunity to learn how everything works. And to learn, one of the main things I learned from doing that was to really trust and enjoy and collaborate with other department heads. Because you would go, you'd have a very specific idea of a joke and maybe you needed a costume. And then I learned that instead of saying like, the costume has to be like this, it was really valuable to be like, hey, here's the joke we're going for. Here's what we thought. What do you think? And then these people in their various departments are often, it's like, it's just wonderful to get their input. When it becomes collaborative, the product is so much mm-hmm. better.
Did the directing inform the writing?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really great opportunity. There is, when you have to actually produce the thing, that, mm-hmm. and by produce, I mean be the director with the boots on the ground, it's eye-opening. It's very easy to write things that are unproducible.
Sure.
And it's very sobering to be the person who has to make the thing you said you were going to get done, you know?
Yeah.
But it's fun. And then some things, like we did one thing, we did a recurring bit called budget cuts on the show. And one of the budget cuts we had was that they could only afford one camera, so they had to do everything with mirrors. And so we had this mirror set up, and we had five mirrors, and one camera was looking through five mirrors, and we had it so that we shot Joel. I don't know if everybody remembers Joel. He was the announcer. He was always like, hey, Conan! And he was like 600 feet away. It was really cool. It was fun.
Wow.
I don't know. There's more fun stuff, but
so okay. So what happened?
Wait, so Parks and Rec. Yes. So Mike said.
So he was already doing Parks and Rec.
No. He was on The Office, and he and Greg uh-huh. Daniels were creating a new show, and they didn't know what the new show was. But Charlie and I basically went out.
How do you create a new show and not know what the show is?
They had a few ideas they were bandying about, and I think Mike really wanted it to be about government and local government. They didn't have a lead yet. Mm-hmm. So things really changed when it became Amy Poehler. It sort of solidified and crystallized more. And they were interviewing for that and for a position at The Office. And ironically, or coincidentally, Charlie and I were the two people they were interviewing. And so then Charlie ended up getting hired at The Office. And they asked us both which we wanted to do. And Charlie said The Office. And I said Parks and Rec.
And had you and Mike stayed friends and close the whole time?
Not super close, but
you kept in touch.
But we were close friends, but we didn't hang out that way. He lived in LA, I lived in New York.
Right.
So I chose, I think there's another lesson, I chose to do Parks and Rec. I mean, Charlie's life has been great, so it's not like that great a lesson. But I always think if you have the opportunity to get in on the ground floor, it's really valuable. It's right. So, because instantly, if I had gone to The Office was in season 6 at that point. They had a hierarchy, they had their star writers, I would have risen up the ranks. It would have taken years to rise up the ranks. At Brooklyn, I had a very low title, but by the end of the first year, I was the number 2 on the show.
Are you talking about Parks and Rec?
Sorry, at Parks.
Yeah.
Sorry, coronavirus. not a doctor. She'll help me. It's reassuring that you're here, but that there's only one of you is a little worrisome.
Get in on the ground floor.
Get in on the ground floor. But if you can. I mean, there are times in your life where you can take risks, and there are times in your life where it's harder to take risks.
Yeah.
But and that risk was immediately made more risky as soon as they hired Amy, because the show was guaranteed, it was picked up for 13 episodes. Mm-hmm. And I quit my job at Conan. My wife was a lawyer at a hedge fund. She quit her job. We moved to L.A., Amy got hired, and she was pregnant. And so to make it work, they pared it down to 6 episodes.
Wow.
And the way it works in American television is if you're a writer, you're paid by episode. So it was like a big
financial risk.
And then the show didn't do well in that first season. It had a hard, we were taking time to figure it out. I think the actors were taking time to figure it out. I think the audience took time to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And then it came back, and it had, and I was there for 5 years, and I did 90 episodes there.
Wow.
But, and it was a transformative, wonderful experience. But it was, yeah, it was a risk. I guess what I'm saying is, like you, I am a hero. And then, so when we were there, after 3 years, there was a chance the show was going to get canceled.
Don't worry about it.
There was a chance that the show was going to get canceled. And so I wrote a pilot, sort of defensively. And the pilot was called Family Practice. And it was about a family medical practice. Mm-hmm. It was like three generations of doctors who had a family medical practice. They can cure others, but can they cure each other?
Love
I'm
it.
I'm kidding. That was not a... Somebody visibly...
Recoiled.
I'm just saying that's... You can imagine that they would say that. Their only illness is one another. And it was a multicam. I wrote it as a single cam, and they picked it up as a multicam, which was weird, so I had to rewrite it. And it had a great cast. It had Christopher Lloyd as
the
grandfather.
Made.
We made the pilot. Christopher Lloyd was the grandfather. Gene Smart and Jerry Burns were the parents. Wow. And then the younger people were people that I don't think you've heard of. But we had as a guest star who was so good that we promoted her to a regular, Octavia Spencer.
Oh, no way.
She was a receptionist. She, I think, had already shot The Help. So, like, she would have, if we had gotten picked up, we would have had an Oscar-winning actress
wow.
on. And she was, it was so funny because it was like, it was fine. The pilot's fine. But she was so great. And it was so clear she was a star. Anyway, so I think that
you
that's...
You did this while you were...
At Brooklyn. At
Parks.
Parks. What
Rec.
Is going on? Coronavirus.
Coronavirus.
Coronavirus. It's gone in my brain.
Okay, so like at the same time or like when you've got a little window...
It was
window
in a hiatus and then a little bit of that time.
Yeah.
And then I think maybe that scared Mike that I would do something without him. And so...
You guys have a codependent relationship?
No, but just I think when you run a show for a long time and then you have a writer who's kind of come up, you're kind of like, if he's going to do something, I deserve to get a piece of it or something. No, I'm kidding. I don't know. I think he thought it would be fun to work with me. I don't know. Now I sound like I'm throwing stones in a coronavirus-filled house. Mike, or maybe you just realized, oh, that I could leave and it would be fun to do another project. So if I was going to leave, we should do the project together. So we decided to create a show
you.
Together. Yes.
Great.
I think. I don't know.
She thinks he does.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay. Thank you. She's very close with him. So we decided to create a show together. And really, a lot of the impetus for Brooklyn, there were two main things that sort of led to Brooklyn. And one of the main things was that I and he love cop comedies, and that there's a long established history of great cop shows mm-hmm. from 48 Hours, and you know there are a million of them. And I always like watching those shows, mm-hmm. and I like cop dramas too. Mm-hmm. So there was that going on. And then the other thing was a very difficult thing. We always felt like a barrier to entry for Parks and Recreation was that it's such a specific and obscure world yeah. that in order to tell the stories, we had to put in so much pipe.
You had to educate the audience.
Yeah, we had to educate
the
audience.
It works.
And you know how, like, a good SNL sketch, you'll say, oh, it's the sarcastic clapping family. And people are like, got it. That's funny. And everything, every time somebody's like. And you can be summed up in one sentence. Yeah. Parks and Rec is, like, the opposite. It was so hard to be like, they're doing an environmental impact report and the town millionaire doesn't want, you know, like you have to explain it. And then the stories would be great and really funny and fun and people really like them. And so I thought if we set it in the world of the police, instead of having to explain what an environmental impact report is, you literally could start with it, with the camera on 99th Precinct. You could tilt down to Jake walking in next to Terry and Terry could say, hey Jake, there's a murder we've got to solve. And it's like, okay, I get it.
You have the shorthand.
You have a shorthand for everything, uh-huh. and everyone's familiar. And interestingly, the show has done very well internationally. It's very big in Brazil. It's very big in Ukraine. It's very big in... And I think part of that is that there are so many cop shows. People are so familiar with the language, both the visual language and the language of cop shows, of American cop shows, uh-huh. that it's like... It's just... easy. Now, ironically, it is very difficult to come up with and to make inventive cop stories. So we just traded one problem for another, one difficulty for another. It's like the number of times you have to come up with, like, well, this clue was planted here, and then that led to this. You know, it's difficult.
So were there other ideas you were batting around, or did you, like, was there something discarded?
I'm sure there were a ton. I mean, I always want to write about a biochemistry lab because of that.
No doubt.
For real. I had an idea. I feel like everybody who tries to write a pilot at some point has an idea that's like, it's a research station on the South Pole. Because it's like, it's just those seven people, you know. Right. And in a way, I think Last Man on Earth was really genius. It was really fantastic. But when I read that and half the, and like, people would be like, that's so inventive. I was like, I think what they did was so inventive, but I do feel like every time you, it's like your first thought is like, how can I make it so that it's just these people that I have to talk about or whatever? Yeah. I'm not saying Last Man on Earth was a first thought idea. It was great.
So what was the process of getting Brooklyn Nine-Nine off the ground?
So Mike and I met once a week for breakfast and bandied about ideas. We pretty quickly settled on a police station. The initial pitch was it was in the boonies. It was like in the middle of nowhere. And then he said, why don't we put it in Brooklyn or somewhere? Because Parks and Rec was kind of set in the middle of nowhere. So we didn't want it to be... So we set it in Brooklyn, and the original joke...
You lived in Brooklyn.
And I had lived in Brooklyn. And the original... And the precinct is actually in one of the neighborhoods that I... It's the 7-8 in real life. And so the original joke, though, was that if you looked at a New York City subway map, the precinct was so far away, it was under the metal frame that held it in place. And then when we pitched that, Kevin Riley, who was in charge of Fox at the time, said, I don't understand why you're doing that. Is the joke that they're going to be solving, like, shitty crimes? And we're like, no, this is going to be normal crimes. I talked like that back then. And he was like, so why don't you just make it a normal precinct? It doesn't have to be the best. It doesn't have to be the worst. And we were like, yeah, that's a good idea. So that's what we did, and it was a great idea. And the other big difference was in the in our first draft, Jake was the new person, and he was coming in, and it was really interesting. The biggest change, I would say, obviously the biggest change was that Holt was the new person. And what we realized was a person with Jake's personality, when they're new, they seem like an asshole. Like, if a new person comes in and they're, like, teasing... If he came in and he was teasing Amy, you'd be like, fuck you. Who are you to tease Amy? She rocks. But if they've got a history of 5 years together and they laugh at each other, then it's great. You get it. He's the class clown. And so that was a massive shift and a really important one in the show.
Right. That you discovered what? While writing the pilot?
Yeah, that we discovered after writing the first draft. That it was based on a set of notes. And I forget exactly what the notes were. It might have been a thing like, we don't feel... They wanted us to write it more for Andy because we had written it before we had Andy.
Did you just pitch Fox verbally?
So we pitched, we had a 20-minute pitch.
Yeah.
We pitched all the networks, all of them, partly thanks to Mike's heat. They all bid on it.
They listened to your pitches.
They listened to our pitches and they bid on it. And then, so there was a little bit of a bidding war. And then... It ended up at Fox, and one of the things we wanted was a casting director right off the bat. So when we were actually writing the pilot, we were already meeting with people.
Oh, wow.
So we had we hired Allison Jones, who is like the best, literally the best casting director in history. There's a New Yorker article about her that is so fascinating, but she casts The Office, she casts all of Judd Apatow's stuff, she casts all of Mike's stuff now. She's great. So... We brought her on. We met with Terry really early on. The reason the character's name is Terry is because we met with him, and we're like, we should put Terry in. and so that was part of it. And then we wrote a first draft, and then they had notes on the first draft. And then,
so Brooklyn Nine-Nine has such a wonderfully diverse cast. Was that something that you knew you wanted right from the beginning?
It is. It is.
Like, was casting influencing this, or is this something that was really...
It was a combination. Uh-huh. So we knew we wanted a diverse cast, and we knew... One of the reasons we chose the NYPD was also because, in addition to the other stuff that I said, it's it's 50% diverse. Mm-hmm. So it felt like we could do a very diverse cast in a very natural way mm-hmm. without having to comment on it, without it making it in and of itself the story.
Right.
And then when we auditioned, the only parts we auditioned, because we were going to hire Terry, Holt was going to be offer only, and he was one of the last people added to the cast, but he was going to be, like, we knew we were going to get kind of a big actor who wouldn't audition. So we auditioned both of the lady parts. Sounded bad? You have auditioned a number of lady parts yourself. Anyway, so in addition to the women,
lady parts,
to the lady parts, mm-hmm. we auditioned the Charles is, mm-hmm. And so we were really open in all of those parts for anyone, mm-hmm. and we hired. And we thought, to be quite honest, originally there was a good chance that Chelsea Peretti, with whom we had worked mm-hmm. on Parks and Rec, and whom Mike and I thought was, still continue to think, is one of the funniest human beings in the world, we were like, oh, she'll be Rosa.
Oh.
So in a lot of ways, we wanted her to be Rosa, and the network was kind of like, we don't buy her as a cop, which is interesting. And so we were like, can we write a new part for her? And they said, yes.
Wow.
And meanwhile, we had auditioned other people for the part, and Stephanie just killed it. Like, she had also beaten, don't tell Chelsea I said this, but for that part, she'd kind of beaten Chelsea for the part. And then Melissa had the best Amy audition. And we were really, it was an open call. Like, we were auditioning everyone. We weren't like...
No whiteys allowed?
No whiteys allowed, or only Latinx mm-hmm. people, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we hadn't done that. It was open, but it was open... with diversity in mind. And so Melissa really didn't have much of a comedy background. She'd been in a soap opera. And she had been, I think she'd done a guest part on some other comedy, but we did a part of our audition where they would improvise. And no woo from the improv person, but okay. Where we would improvise, and she had the best improv. She kept up with Andy, and she actually had what we call the blow to the scene, where she had the funniest joke that we ended the scene on. She was the only person who did that. And so we cast her, and then we cast, and there's this great story that I only heard like 3 years in, where we cast her, and she had become friends with Stephanie, and when Stephanie heard we had cast Amy, Melissa, mm-hmm. she started crying because she thought there's no way they'll cast another Latina person. And then she was cast, I think, either later that night or the next day. And so, and that was really cool. I mean,
oh my
I had no
God,
idea.
I love that so much.
And then with Andre, it's offer only. He'd never done comedy. He'd done light comedy. He'd done, that sounds insulting, but I don't mean that. I don't mean it's like light comedy. He'd done Men of a Certain Age, which is great. And I totally recommend. I actually really like it. But he'd never done like hard jokes. Mm-hmm. And so we had a Skype meeting with him and he smiled and he's got like a billion watt smile. And we're like, I think he'll be okay. And then when we did it, the first time we heard him read the part was when we did the table read.
Oh, wow.
And then his first line, he said something like, what, Peralta? Or something. And he killed. Like everyone was like, that's the guy. And we wanted to make it, so the other big sort of interesting thing about the show was mm-hmm. that his character is gay. Mm-hmm. And that, the design of that was that we wanted the character to have overcome something. Mm-hmm. And we wanted him to be in charge of a precinct for the first time mm-hmm. and have felt like his time was long past due. And since the NYPD is a paramilitary organization, like all police forces, it's also, you know, has a history of homophobia. Mm-hmm. And so we thought that was the right thing to do. And then we wanted to design the character so that his sexuality was never the butt of the joke. It was just an aspect of who he was.
Yeah,
and that's kind of, that was our MO with all of the parts. Because they're with, so like.
And the whole show in general.
Yeah.
Did you have parameters or rules to go, we do this or we don't do this, or like when you started out?
Yeah, when we started out, we had rules about, yes, for sure. Like we would never do a joke that where the butt of the joke was Holt being gay. Mm-hmm. Or where like one of the Latina characters had to do something that you would see in a sitcom traditionally, like a spicy Latina thing.
Sure. You know, were you like, ever encouraged to do those things by the
we
network? Really,
we weren't. But I mean, in a joke, in a writer's room, like a billion jokes are pitched. So I'm sure there were jokes that were like, oh, that could be funny. No, we're not doing that. Right. You know, but the biggest rules we set up, I think people sort of intuitively understood what we were going for mm-hmm. with that. So I don't think there was ever that much of an issue. The biggest thing was just what kind of cases we would do, how seriously, how good they should be as police officers, that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. We had a lot of rules about.
And you made this show at a time where, like, New York cops are not very popular people. Like, does
we
that...
We actually made it 2 years before, I'd say.
They were very popular?
They were just... No, and I'm not saying
and
the...
And then...
I'm not saying the problems didn't exist, but the sort of, like... Black Lives Matter and all of that mm-hmm. really started, I'd say, in season two or season three, being a major thing.
And did that affect how you made the show at all or how people perceived the show?
It's a great question. So I think if it had been happening beforehand, I don't know that we would have chosen to do the right. NYPD, to be honest. It was, I think that said, we always modeled a police squad that you would want to be your police. They were good people who wanted to do good and were good at their jobs. And
tell we tried how you want the world to be,
how you want
not
the world to
how
be.
The world is.
And we tried to not be so naive by often having them interact with bad cops and having to call out bad cops mm-hmm. and stuff like that. That said, I mean, we did, we've tried to tackle it. Like we did the Moo Moo episode where Terry's racially profiled and stuff. And the tough thing is, because we've made them all so woke, it becomes very hard to do some of these issues because there's almost no conflict. In other words, like you can't have a story where they're all on the same side. And even in Moo Moo, where Terry is racially profiled, he goes and he tells everyone, and everyone is like, fuck that. That guy sucks. Screw him. We should report him. And it's kind of like, that's the end of the story. When we were breaking the story, mm-hmm. when we got to that point, I was like, I don't know what to do. And then I was pitching it to
Andre. Have you guys seen this episode?
So I was pitching it to Andre. The story really broke because I pitched it to Andre. And I said, and then he tells Captain Holt. And obviously Captain Holt's like, I will file that report. And he goes, I don't think Captain Holt would file the report. And I was like, what? And that became the act two break. Was Captain Holt refuses to file the report. And he said, if you look at Captain Holt's career, he has withered, he has withstood and bottled down, he's been insulted for being gay, for being black, he's been passed over time and time again, and his strategy is that he will, in the future, be in charge of the system and change the system. And so he says, I think Captain Holt would give that piece of advice to Terry. And then Terry's response is like, fuck that. Mm-hmm. This guy did something wrong and I'm going to deal with it now. Mm-hmm. And so that really blew it open. And then we did a thing we really rarely do where the next act was basically just a conversation between Captain Holt and Terry for the entire act where they're discussing that. And then the other thing we realized, because that was the first sort of like issues-y episode, the other thing we tried to do was we tried really hard, and we tried in all of these to, even though we have to do so much oversimplifying just to do, in general, because it's a 21-minute and 35-second mm-hmm. long episode, but we tried to
never... You do this brilliantly, by the way.
Oh, that's...
Like, you handle this, it's quite amazing.
We try to make it clear that there is no simple answer. So, like, mm-hmm. at the end of it, Terry says what he needs to say and does what he needs to do, but he also doesn't get the promotion. So, and like, that was a really important thing. And that was like a thing. And then when we did He Said, She Said, which was about a woman who was, it was like it was our sort of a Me Too movement episode. We wanted to make sure there was a draft of that where at the very end, the guy who has like,
just tell, yeah.
Sorry, it was like
just
a guy,
tell them a little.
It's like a workplace. So it starts out, because you also, when we do these things, we also try to make them Brooklyn Nine-Nine-y and funny, which can be difficult. So it starts out and there's a guy, there's an assault that they have to investigate. A guy's penis has been broken. And so they go to the hospital and it turns out his penis was broken because he was trying to assault, force himself on a woman at work, and she hit him in the crotch with his signed Tiger Wood golf club. I don't know if the Tiger Wood part made it, but for a long time, Tiger Wood was in there. And so it becomes a he said, she said, and she ends up, and the firm, like the company at which they work, tries to buy her out, tries to silence her, and then Amy kind of takes it on herself to get the woman to speak, and she's like, if we don't press charges, there won't be change. And then...
And she's got her own story, and she's got her own story. So lovely.
And with the whole episode was really built around the opportunity for Amy to tell that story, to be honest. I mean, that's like where we came up with it. Because it was based on a thing where we had been talking, and I think Andy said that he'd been talking about some horrible Me Too story, and he'd been talking with a female friend of his, I don't think it was a cast member, and she was like, yeah, everyone has that story. And he was like, what? And then she was like, every woman I know has that story exactly, whatever that story was.
I love that scene between, Jake
and Amy.
Yeah. And they're in a relationship, and he doesn't know this about her.
So that was sort of the foundational element of it. But even at the end of that episode, the woman does press charges. The guy is dismissed. She doesn't lose her job, but she ends up quitting because basically she's like, I've been ostracized in this workplace. And so in an earlier draft, I think even at the table, she had just, it was kind of like she won.
A
happy ending. And then Andy and Melissa were both like, this doesn't feel genuine. This feels like this kind of shitty. It was
top.
A weird thing because we were also like, yeah, but we also don't want to do an episode where we're saying like, if you do tell, it's going to suck. Because you want to also
encourage
people to talk. So it's like, it becomes difficult. But then that was sort of the compromise. And it's never perfect, but it's like what we try to do. And we've talked about doing immigration, and there's like a little bit of an immigration episode in this season. But it's really hard because you want it to be a story that is funny, and also that you give fair credence to.
Yeah. Or Game Night, is that the name of the episode?
Game Night, yeah. So okay. That was based on Stephanie, does everyone know the episode Game Night? That's the episode where, so here's an interesting thing about Game Night.
Yeah.
No, it's not, that makes it sound like, I didn't want to do it. No, the thing about Game Night was, Stephanie had come out as bisexual online, and we had talked a lot about whether or not the character should. And the biggest hangup was, did it feel real that Rosa hadn't come out? And then when we kind of, and she was like, I'm a lot like Rosa in that way, and I hadn't come out, and my family is important, and blah, blah, blah. So we kind of started developing it that way. And she was really integral in the development. I really wanted Jake to be on the story as Rosa's friend. And I was really worried that if Holt was too intimately involved, it would sort of become a Holt story, even in some ways, even more than it would become a Rosa story, that we would sort of find out his coming out story and all this other stuff. And then, this goes to the importance of having, I think, diversity on your staff. One of our gay writers.
What is
kept
the makeup
saying,
of your writer's room? Just sidebar.
We have. It's like 60, changes all the time.
Okay.
So every season.
Okay, continue.
We try to be as diverse as we can be and as male-female balanced as we can be. I was just going to say, this guy was like, I think Holt has to say something. And then I was like, what do you think he should say? And then he came up with that line right there, which was at the very end, Holt says, every time somebody
comes out,
tells the truth about themselves, the world becomes a better, more interesting place. Yeah. And then he's like, so thank you for making the world a better, more interesting place. And it was like, he said it, and I was like, I had shivers. And then it's like, it is the one line from the thing that everyone remembers. And it's because it's great, and it's like the best moment in the whole thing. And it's like, it was so worth putting in and wonderful.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for writers of how to tackle or the way in to deal with social issues in the sitcom container? It sounds like you've had a...
I think it's really so dependent on the show. I really think it's dependent on the show. I mean, I think a lot of shows now in this cable streaming world, it's a lot easier to do. I think the weird thing for our show is that we are like really in a lot of ways a very traditional comedy-driven show. And so you just want to make sure in that world that you've kind of earned the right to do it and that you're doing it in a way that doesn't alienate your audience. But there are great shows that where it's like front and center, you know, I think. Like, have people seen Rami? Have you guys seen that?
Mm-mm.
Is that not here? Is Hulu here? Oh. I think Rami is really interesting. There's like, wait, Hulu's not here.
No.
Bring it. But we're on Netflix here, right?
Yes.
All right, that's cool.
Okay, all right. I've only got a couple minutes before we do start our question and answer. Do you have anything that you would like to redo? Like something that you, like an episode that you've made on Brooklyn Nine-Nine or something else, you were like, I wish I could take another stab at that, or anything you regret?
I instantly feel like a politician and like understand why politicians are never want to apologize to me. Yeah, there are definitely some things that we've done. We did an episode called Emmy Time, which I think has like kind of fat shamey jokes in them that I don't think we intended to be that way, but I think they came off that way. And I think it's, I think it was like low hanging fruit and it wasn't funny, but it was like, we just couldn't figure out the story or anything. And then the cadaver was like, was obese. And so there were jokes about the cadaver. And I really think it was just like, we were stuck. That doesn't justify it. I would change that probably. I think a lot of people wish we'd never had Charles into Rosa in the beginning. And maybe we could have handled that differently. But I do think, I don't think it's bad for a person to have a crush on another person at work. It is bad for them to pursue the person after the person has said that they don't want to be pursued. And it's certainly bad for them to like force themselves. I do think the dynamic of Charles and Rosa was always one in which she had the power over him. And I don't think he was ever threatening or tried to be threatening. If anything, he was a pest, which isn't great and wasn't a great thing. But like some people have painted that almost as like you guys did something bad. I think if anything, we made him kind of unlikable. And like, maybe I guess it was a little inappropriate in the workforce for, place for him to be doing that. But I would say in fairness to us, I think we just, that wasn't the intention of the thing. I think the intention was if they had had chemistry, the actors and the characters, you would have seen it possibly as a will they, won't they. And I think the fact that the characters kind of didn't have that kind of chemistry and maybe... It's easy as an audience to realize that before we as a writer's room who's like three or four episodes ahead
hindsight
realizes it.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, I would maybe change that or have her like, have him realize it was shut down sooner. That said, some of the episodes where he's realizing it and then decide, and then they become friends and then she comes to his rescue with his ex-wife and stuff, those are really, I really like those episodes, and I don't, I wonder if they'd be as impactful if not for that history, but I'm sensitive to that one, and I think, like, on Parks and Rec, there's a debate about how long that pit should have been around, and there was a point in the writer's room where we were all like, can we get rid of the pit? And Mike was like, every time somebody says we should fill the pit in, I think we should dig it twice as deep. And I literally said, you sound like George Bush talking about the Iraq War. And he didn't say anything. But so I kind of understand because it was like so far from our intention, the way it was taken. But yes, I could see wanting to redo that. And then obviously there are jokes and little things here and there that you would, that one wishes they could redo, I think.
The best version when you're watching it on TV.
Yeah. Well, for some of them, you're like, the best version would be 73 seconds shorter. Right. And for some of them, you're like, the best version would be a minute and 80 seconds longer.
Yeah.
2 minutes and 20 seconds later. Sorry. But, I mean, it's interesting because you have to get it into this 21 minutes and 35 seconds.
Well, show is amazing.
Oh, thank you. I hope nobody tell me what you would change because we can't change it. I don't want to hear it.
I didn't ask them.
I know, but now all I'm thinking is, what do you guys think we should change?
You're awesome. We love you. These guys are going to ask questions now. Yeah, I'm going to open the floor up.
All right. Hello. First of all, welcome. Second, my question is in regards to guest casting, like casting guest stars. And do you think, this is a role that might come back again? I mean, an obvious one would be Craig Robinson as the Pontiac Bandit, but...
Best. Yeah, he's the best.
Yeah.
Great question. So I think it depends on the part and it depends on the availability of the actor. Also, early on, Fox was always like, get a guest star. You guys should get guest stars. And then it's like, okay, we'll get Bill Hader, but he can only be here for 6 hours on one day. And so you get an episode where Bill Hader gets killed or dies of a heart attack. This is literally what happened. So in that situation, with Paul F. Tompkins, we're all huge Paul F. Tompkins fans. Huge. And it was like, oh, he'd be funny for that part, but it's going to be a waste. And then it was like, I don't know if there'll be a season 4 or 5. I don't know that we'll get him. And so we were like, let's just get him and we'll use him. For the Pontiac Bandit, in the very, very first pitch documents that we wrote about the show, we said that we wanted to do, you have to like talk about 6 different stories. And one of the stories was that there was a character named the Mazda Bandit and Mazda didn't clear. And Pontiac doesn't exist anymore. And the idea was Jake's nemesis, and it was kind of like what it is, but he would send, it was like a serial killer, but instead of sending parts, body parts to the cop, he was sending like parts of a car to Jake. And then we did it, and we cast Craig, who's amazing. And then their chemistry is like almost the opposite of the Charles Rosa thing, but their chemistry was so great that it totally changed. They became friends. And there was just like, it was undeniable. Like in that first episode, they talk about that Disney film, 5-0 Goes West. And it's like, I think they may have improvised it. And it's like, but you just couldn't have a thing. Because one idea for the arc of the whole series was like, the very last episode, he catches the Mazda Bandit, you know? And it's like, no, they're best friends.
I have 2 questions, if that's okay. Is it okay? my first question is, you mentioned earlier that in the audition process, you get the actors to improvise. I was wondering if there were any like iconic moments in episodes that made it into episodes that the actors improvised?
Great question. I'm so bad at answering this because I always forget. And by the time I'm done editing it, I've seen everything a billion times. I'm trying to think. Andy is really a genius at this stuff, and so is Chelsea, and I'm trying to think of the best. I bet you I could Google it and find out, because I've like had to answer it, but fuck, I'll try to think of it.
But they improvise.
So earlier on, there was more gusto and enthusiasm for the process. We've done 143 episodes, but yeah, we would do like 6 takes, and then we would do what's called a fun run, where they could improvise any part. So we would try to get the scripted and then move off of the scripted. And some of the funniest things, a lot of times the act blows are things that Andy has improvised. Okay, do you guys remember the cold open? I still don't know why this is funny, I'll be honest. The one, it just happened, I think this season, maybe it was last season, Boyle Bowling. Boyle Bottle Bowling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I watched that with my brother. We laughed so hard. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Fucking babushka was his. I know she says it, and then he goes, babushka. And I'm like, it doesn't make sense, Andy. He's like, it's funny. And I was like, we'll beat it. And we had, like, scripted ones. And then, nope, that was the one that won.
Thank you. My second question is, what is it like being a working father, having, to work all these long hours on a show and then also having a family at home?
It's difficult. I mean, it's really hard, I have to say. And I mean, if I could do it again, I guess the thing I regret is having kids. No, especially the first few seasons of the show, it's so hard to, like, I just have a personality where I'm not trying to make it good or great. It either just works or it doesn't work. And like, in those early seasons, you don't know what works, and you don't, like, my wife will be like, can't you just, like, work 85% as hard or make it 85% as good? And I'm like, it doesn't work that way to me. It's like, this scene just doesn't work. And then you get it, so it works. And it's like, but it might take hours and hours for that to happen. The nice thing is that the hours are a lot better. And my older daughter is a big fan of the show, which is really nice. And her friends are really big fans of the show. She's 12. And it's like, that is really heartwarming. And I love bringing them to set. And like, they all have little like Brooklyn Nine-Nine hoodies and stuff.
Cute.
They both do. So they wear them to school. And I'm like, oh. But it's hard. It's hard.
Hello.
What does your shirt say?
Boston.
Oh. America sucks.
My grandparents made me get it. My question was, you have all this representation of people who don't normally get representation in other comedies. Was there ever, like, backlash either from the network, writers, anyone, like, when you were deciding on this, or if anyone wanted to change
that?
That's
a great question. There was not. I mean, really, I don't know that the finished product always ends up being as diverse as one would like, but there is, my experience developing for American television networks is there is actually a lot of pressure to have diversity. And I think it's just not always very cleverly applied, and that ends up making it either feel phony or like ends up backfiring in some way. But like, there was never any pushback on that. And that is really encouraged. I know that sounds crazy, and I don't like giving the corporate overlords any credit.
That's awesome.
But
that's
that is
great.
Really, it's that's the case. And again, that's not always what ends up happening, but that is, and if you look at pilots every year over the last 10 years, certainly, you'll see there's a tremendous amount of diversity in the pilots.
On the way here, me and my boyfriend were talking about, you know, the possibility of going into, like, how to write comedy. And I told him, I'm like, I feel kind of lame thinking that I have to know it. It's something that you naturally have. And he's like, of course not. You can develop it. Developing yourself as a comedian, is it something that you kind of, like, look broadly around all the types of comedy? Screwball, slapstick, or do you kind of just focus on the one that you know that you can develop and then bring a group of people along in that same sort of development?
My experience has been more that I just have always sort of written and performed the kind of stuff that I find funny and that I've been drawn to people who have similar sensibilities. But I think there's a merit to both. I mean, I think that there's like, I would love to be a person. I think Judd Apatow is very good. I don't know him. I've like never met him. But I think one of the things that he's really good at is like sensing different comedy talents and really like helping develop them. And if you look, he's you'd be very hard to pinpoint. I mean, I think we really associate him with the sort of Seth Rogen crowd, but that's just one group of people mm-hmm. that he's kind of latched onto. And I think a good comedy is written by a lot of different voices, and there are definitely people who have, like, it's not like the room is, you know, 16 people like me, grammarticians, but it's people, you might have a kind of stonery dude who's got like a stonery dude sense of humor, and you might have like a woman who's like just got like a very funny set of references. And I mean, everyone, it's nice to have everyone's tools in the toolbox.
Okay, I'm going to take this question here, and then I'll get up there. Thank you.
I don't want to be that guy.
Too late. I just wanted to ask, because you mentioned you have like a really large writing team for the show. At what point did you bring in that writing team? Like, presumably, you and Mike hashed out the idea yourselves. What time did you bring
So, you do the pilot, and then they pick up the pilot, and then you staff up right away. And it's not, I was 16, we've never had 16, but like with 10 writers usually at a time. And then the writers stay, nowadays writers stay less for fewer episodes, fewer seasons because there are so many more options and there are very few, like 22 episodes is really, can burn you out.
Hi. I guess my question has to do also with the writing team, because you were talking earlier a little bit about the diversity, and I was wondering how the diversity works behind the camera for the show. Also, I would like to learn a little bit more how it was for the network transition when the show moved from Fox to NBC.
So we really try as hard as we can to read as many women and people of color, and especially on our show, people, LGBT writers. And I hate getting into the numbers because I think there are a million reasons why numbers are the way they are, but we try to be as close to 50% as we can. I mean, we've had like amazing writers who, female writers who've left to have a baby, but, and then the next year it looks like we have one fewer female writer, and it's like, and we've had them also leave to create their own show, which is also like a great thing. And we've had similarly for male writers and stuff. So I know this sounds defensive, but I think our numbers are actually pretty good, but I don't like getting into that game. All I can say is I think we try as hard as we can to keep things as balanced and to hear new voices and to have people of color. And to be honest, it's to our advantage. I mean, it's selfishly, it's to our advantage. We have a show that has people of color and has LGBT characters and has strong women on it. And so that is our goal. The answer to the second question is there was no change. It was really easy because if anything, it's just been easier. They like NBC cares less about stunt casting and stuff like that. And, you know, we were forced to do, I mean, we chose to do a crossover with New Girl, and which I actually really loved New Girl, but like we did not want to, I mean, we chose to, we all thought it would be a good idea, but NBC has never suggested doing that kind of a thing. I mean, some junior executive was like, could you do a crossover with The Good Place? And we were like, they're in heaven. or hell, spoiler alert. They've just been really hands-off. We developed it with Universal. This is maybe too boring, but Universal, which is NBC, is their studio is Universal. We did it at Universal, so it's always been the same studio. So we've just, it was a very easy transition.
Can you speak to the quality that served you best as like a staff writer or a junior writer, and then how that changed and the quality that serves you best as a producing writer as you're moving up the ranks?
Yeah. being a genius. No. I think as a junior writer, I really think being a junior writer, I think just having perseverance and like trying to enjoy the job and having fun in the job. It's writing comedy, it should be fun. Not getting too caught up in the politics, not keeping score, just in working at places, if you can do it, that you like, where you like the product, so you enjoy the end result, and hopefully you like the other people. And then I think when I got to Parks, I had a kind of lucky situation because I knew Mike. But I was able to use both that, the perseverance, being able to pitch stuff, not getting down if he didn't take stuff, but also maybe because I knew him, and so this might be unfair, I was able to really argue with him about stuff, and I was able to say, hey, I don't think that works, or could we do this like this? And I think that that helped him. Mike's a genius, but I think that me being like an impediment to him only made him leap higher. That said, like,
you played hard to get, basically.
Yeah, I nagged him. Yeah. But that's a difficult balance, because if you're like a junior writer and you're working on a show and you keep telling, you know, you should never pitch a problem without a solution, first of all. And if you're constantly pitching problems, that's not a great look either, you know? So it is a balance, but there are also shows, and I think you can see it, where no one is saying, does that make sense? to the showrunner, and I think, and so like the number two on my show, this guy Luke Del Tredici, is great, and we get in arguments, you know, about stories and stuff, and then the best version of the show is somewhere between my feelings about the show and his feelings and Andy's feelings, and it's a collaboration.
Thank you so much for being here to share everything with us, first
finally
of all.
Finally!
I think what's remarkable is the first season played out like a second or third season show in terms of the punchiness, the development, and you know that's a huge part of the success.
Oh, thank you. That's such a nice compliment.
and what's remarkable now in its ninth season, is that right?
This is seven and we're going into eight.
Okay.
Don't curse us. I mean, bless us.
Yeah, right. What's remarkable about it now is that it still has that punch. It's still... it's even more punchier now than it ever has been. What is that a conscious thing in terms of like how you developed it from the gate to the early point and how you keep it fresh and punchy to this day?
That is just wonderful. And that's like the pull quote I'd love to have in my tombstone. Oh. Coronavirus. Also, do people have tombstone pull quotes? Anyway. That's actually kind of a funny idea for a tombstone. Hold on, let me write that down. Note to self. So that's very nice of you. I think I agree with you that it was I think the first season was good. Like it felt gelled to me. I'm not trying to sound braggy. I'm saying like and I think a lot of that was luck. Like and Allison Jones, we had a cast that really gelled. And I think that helped. And there's some clunker episodes in there, like ME Time, I don't think is as great. And there are other episodes where we're really figuring it out. But the funny thing is, there are a lot of journalists who will write, like, first season, they were still finding their feet. And I'm like, I felt like we knew where our feet were. Thank you very much. But I mean, and I think it got better after the first season. Anyway, now I sound like a braggart. But I think a lot of it had to do with the cast. I think we really lucked out. I think So one of the most important things, obviously, on any show is the cast chemistry, and you just can't plan for that. And so Allison Jones was great, and she really assured us. We, you know, both Melissa and Stephanie were virtual unknowns, and Andre had never done comedy, and this is a different type of part for Andy. So all of those things, it really could have gone a different way. So I think I really give credit to the cast for faking it until we made it to some extent. And then for the other stuff, I'd say Andy is really involved in the editing. So every cut of the episode, Andy does a pass of notes that he gives to me, and then my editor and I curse him and do most of his notes. I mean, like 8 pages of notes, like really notes. He's truly a producer on the show. He's incredibly bright. And Andy cuts the show faster. He wants us to cut it faster and faster every single season and every episode.
So your scripts get longer?
Our scripts are pretty long. They're like 36, 37 pages. And we'll do like a 36-page script and we'll be like 35 seconds over.
Wow.
Because also everyone talks fast. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be times where he's like, you could take another frame out of this. And it'll be, and my editor will be like, he wants him to talk on top of himself. And it's interesting because I noticed watching it here with you guys, there are times where that's great, and there are times where you're kind of like, oh, you missed a joke because you were laughing. Uh-huh. But rewatch it. but I do think his point is like, he's like, if you look at comedies from 20 years ago, if you look at comedies from 40 years ago, it's slower. They're slower, and then they're much slower. And he's like, comedy just speeds up. He's like, if you want this show to live forever, make it as fast as is humanly possible. Wow. Now, the interesting thing is we did a panel or a Comic-Con or something like that, and somebody said, I think the show's too fast, and I think it was better season 5. And I texted Andy right away.
All right, that's on that note, that's all we have time for. Let's give a big round of applause.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this conversation recorded live from the Vancouver International Film Festival. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Creator Talks and Masterclasses are programmed by Fran Bergen. The podcast is created by Ellen Hadley and Clem LeBay on the unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh Nation.